way back when. To head off conflict and subversion, they asked every working person, are you now or have you ever been?
Welcome to the Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, BC. In Canada, can you be arrested and imprisoned for your beliefs, or because you fit the profile of an individual who could commit a crime sometime in the future? You probably answered no, but you would be wrong, because this is precisely what has been happening to some people under the Security Certificate Program in Canada. On today's Brown Bagger, you will hear Ardil Shekawy, one of five men who have been imprisoned in Guantanamo North without trial, and Jason Grattle, lawyer with the BC Civil Liberties Association. They were speaking at a panel discussion at the SFU Harbour Centre on June 26, 2009. To start, Jason Grattle explains the nature of the Security Certificate Program and likens it to the state of law during medieval times.
My name is Jason Grattle. I'm the Vice President of the BC Civil Liberties Association. I'm a lawyer by trade, and that's in one sense how I come to stand before you today. Before beginning, I'd like to thank all the people who have contributed to Adil's presence here today and who have worked hard on his brief over the last 6 years. Council of Canadians, Amnesty International, No One Is Illegal, Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and Justice for Ardil Shekawy Coalition. None of this would be possible without all of your hard work. When I first heard of security certificates about 4.5 years ago, I didn't believe it. It was something that I just couldn't stomach. I couldn't believe that five men were being held without disclosure of evidence, without knowing the reasons for their detention, without the right to be present at their own trials. That seemed to me positively medieval. It belonged in a different time, and it belonged in a different place. From my trial sensibilities and everything I was taught in law school and all of the overlay that we get about trial fairness and due process in this country, it seemed to me too much of an abomination even to be possible. And it was for that reason that I really didn't do anything about it for about 2 months, because it just wasn't possible to think that way about the Canadian legal system. But when I got down to researching the issue like lawyers are supposed to, what I learned was stunning. In the ordinary case, under immigration law, is captured by the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, of course not everybody is allowed in Canada. Under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Section 6, Canadians have the right to remain and enter and leave Canada at will. And there's some limited protection afforded to permanent residents as well. But in the ordinary immigration case, not everybody is allowed in. And there are certain classes of individuals who are just not permitted in the country. They're deemed to be inadmissible. And a lot of reasons for their inadmissibility. One is serious criminality. If you commit such and such an offense punishable by such and such a term of imprisonment, you're not allowed in. If you're involved with organized crime, you're not allowed in. If you're involved in breaches of international law or human rights, you're not supposed to be allowed in. Generally speaking, when it comes to inadmissibility hearings, they're a matter of administrative process. The Immigration and Refugee Board takes up some evidence and decides, more or less in an open administrative process, whether or not a person's admissible. The person who is sought to be deported has the right to see all the evidence gathered against them, and they have a right to present their case. That's the ordinary situation. Security certificates are something quite and entirely different. Security certificates are a highly politicized process that begin with the signing of a certificate by the Minister of Immigration. And what the certificate does is it effectively deems from the instant of signing, rather than after a court process, it deems from the instant of signing that a person is inadmissible, and it allows for the person's arrest. and it leaves it to that person to establish in a security certificate process that in fact they are admissible, that they are not inadmissible. And security certificates can issue when a person is deemed to be a threat to the national security of Canada. What is the national security of Canada? That would seem to be a straightforward question. One would think that to be a threat to the national security of Canada, you'd have to represent a direct threat. There'd have to be some solid evidence, at least reasonable and probable grounds, if not some higher standard of proof. And it would have to be a threat to Canada itself. Not so. A 2002 decision of the Supreme Court of Canada decided very unhappily immediately after September 11th, decided that what threat to the national security of Canada entails is not a proof of a threat, but rather an objectively reasonable suspicion of a threat. And it doesn't have to be a direct threat to Canada. It can be an indirect threat to Canada as well. And lastly, it doesn't even have to be to Canada. It can be to any other country in any way associated with Canada. So a threat to national security is, just to recap, a suspicion, could amount to a suspicion of an indirect threat to a country other than Canada. So we can see already the ground rules set for security certificates are a little bit lax. The process itself, once a security certificate is signed, involves immediate detention and a right of review of that detention. Now, generally speaking, what's required is that for the detainee to establish that the security certificate is unreasonable. The process in which they're entitled to establish that proposition is in federal court, not before the Immigration and Refugee Board. There's, at least initially before 2008, there was no requirement for the minister or the investigative agencies to provide all of the evidence gathered to the federal court judge. And there was an obligation, not to the federal court judge, nor to the deportee. The Immigration and Refugee Protection Act placed an obligation on the judge to keep any evidence that might be a threat to national security away not only from the public, but from the detainee and the detainee's counsel. The judge, rather than having an obligation to provide even information that didn't involve a threat to national security to the deportee, was only required to provide a summary of the evidence to the deportee. Now, all of that is totally out of keeping with the usual standards for due process. And anybody who's familiar with the development of the English common law since the abolition of the Star Chamber knows how inappropriate all of that is. The Immigration and Refugee Protection Act stated that its intention in creating the security certificate process was to allow for the quick and speedy deportation of individuals who were inadmissible to Canada. In reality, the exact opposite occurred. All of these individuals who were deemed to be a threat to the security of Canada didn't have the option of returning home. There wasn't a place to deport them, and so the only option was perpetual detention and ongoing dogged, persistent, methodical charter challenge after charter challenge after appeal after further challenge, ongoing argument for ongoing bail applications. And what's happened, rather than having any of these security certificates declared unreasonable, is that the passage of time and the diligence of counsel and the work of nonprofit organizations has so eroded any possible fantasy that a person who held in detention for more than 5 years could constitute a threat to Canada that the five detainees were all released into bail of one type or another. Mr. Jarkawi, who's with us today, still, if you can believe it, on bail. His bail allows him to travel finally. But after now 6 years of nonstop detention and relentless surveillance, he is now deemed to be not a sufficient risk to national security that he can talk to you today. And believe me, that was hard fought. It's a victory, it's a legal victory that Mr. Charkhawi can be before you here today to speak to you about his own experiences. Now, the situation, the initial situation with security certificates was so bad that in 2007, the Supreme Court of Canada struck down large portions of the secrecy provisions that prevented disclosure of the material to the detainee. The rationale was that a person has a fundamental right where their liberty is at stake, where their bodily integrity is at stake. They have a fundamental right to challenge the evidence, to put forward their version of the case. And they can't do that, surprise, surprise, without the evidence being used against them. They can't do that if they're not entitled to be present in court when the case is being argued. And also, unsurprisingly, the judge is unable to do their own job in assessing the value of the evidence and in assessing the merits of the case against the detainee, the potential detainee, without having that crucial third leg of the adversarial system before them to argue the evidence and to argue the law. So that was, large portions of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act were struck down in February of 2007, and the government was given a year to prop up the system. And what they've done is they've created a system of security cleared counsel. The security cleared counsel is something like the invisible third leg of the system. The security cleared counsel is a lawyer who is being properly trained by the Ministry of Justice to keep secrets, in effect. They are given access to the relevant documentation. They are permitted to make arguments in court in two directions. One, to maximize disclosure to the detainee, and secondly, to argue against deportation. But here are the problems, and here's why it's a sort of invisible leg. The public is still not allowed in the courtroom, still a closed courtroom. We don't get to see what goes on. And from our point of view, there's no way of knowing exactly what occurs inside that closed courtroom. That's a big flaw of the system. Another big flaw is that the security-cleared lawyer is not counsel for the detainee. They have an independent statutory mandate. They're not allowed to take instructions from the detainee. They don't necessarily have to do what the detainee says. And they're not, unless permission is granted by the judge, they're not permitted to discuss the evidence disclosed to them or interview with the detainee or interview the detainee about what happened to them. So what do we have? We have what is, in my view, and in the view of many members of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, still a fundamentally flawed system. Of course, there's another charter challenge pending, but there's and this fight is far from over. In 2008, to add insult to injury, the Supreme Court of Canada again had an opportunity to consider Mr. Charkhawi's specific circumstances. It was revealed during, and this was after three appeals, the fourth start to the reasonableness inquiry. It was revealed by the government lawyers that they had forgotten to disclose, perhaps a familiar story, they had forgotten to disclose their notes of two interviews that they had with Mr. Charkhawi. Highly relevant, highly probative, forgotten to disclose. Mr. Charkhawi's counsel made application for the notes and recordings underlying those two reports of interviews, and they had been destroyed. Under a CSIS policy to destroy notes and records and recordings within a year of their creation, or as soon after a report had been created as possible, they are in effect destroying the source documents that are in very ordinary course disclosed in criminal matters, disclosed in civil matters, disclosed in every court process known to the common law system that involves a threat to life and liberty and security of the person. Totally inexcusable, no reason, no proper reason given for it, And again, unsurprisingly, in 2008, the Supreme Court of Canada determined that these underlying notes have to be maintained. They can't be destroyed. They have to be disclosed to the judge. And they ought to be disclosed to the extent possible to the detainee and the detainee's lawyer. And they have to be disclosed in full to the security-cleared counsel, which is, again, an improvement to the system. But we have started with the security certificate process from an abysmally low platform. We have gone all the way back to the star chamber process, and we've been building it up bit by bit, case by case, fighting to maintain standards that we thought we had that were precious to us, that were inviolable, and it turns out they're not. It's a lesson to be learned about our fundamental values, about the nature of our democracy, that it can be taken away on a moment's notice. It can be taken away quietly unless we're all vigilant. Thanks very much.
You are listening to the Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. On today's Brown Bagger, Jason Grattle, lawyer and member of the BC Civil Liberties Association, talked about the security certificate program during a panel discussion on June 26, 2009. Next, Ardil Sharkawi, imprisoned without due process of law for 21 months, talks about his experiences being targeted under that program.
Without lawyers, courageous lawyers and brave activists, I don't think that I could do what I have done during those last 6 years. Perhaps today I would be in a small cell in Morocco. I will start by telling you my story, because I think it's really important to share with you this Kafkaesque story since 2003. So I will start by my arrival in Canada. In 1995, my father, my mother, my sister and me decided to immigrate to Canada. And for us, Canada was American dream, but in French. So the American dream now became nightmare, like you can see. And when we met with the Canadian immigration agent in the Canada embassy in Morocco, in Rabat, in the capital, she told my father, perhaps you are going to regret your choice to go to Canada. Morocco is a beautiful country, there is no snow, no winter, and you are from the middle class, and you have your own house, you have your own business, your wife is working, you have your children in university, and why you want to go to Canada? My father insisted, and now he told me, she advised me about the winter, about the snow, about the jobs, but she never talked to me about thesis. And when we arrived in Canada in 1995, I finished my bachelor degree in 2 years in University of Montreal. And for me, life was normal like any young Canadians. I was doing lots of martial arts, sports, traveling, studying, working part-time. And everything was normal. In 1998, I sponsored my wife from Morocco. And when she came here, we started our life. I was living near my parents' house, and everything was normal. In 2000, my wife asked me to go with her to Morocco to visit her family. And before taking the plane, I was arrested by RCMP's officers, and they asked me to follow them. I followed them in the basement of the airport. And there they checked my luggage, my wallet, everything I have. One of them, Caporal Duval, he testified after on my behalf in the federal court. He gave me an advice. He told me, look, Adil, I will tell you, don't take this plane. Don't go to Morocco. I told him why. He told me because you'll perhaps face some problems there. Problems? I told him, every year I'm going to Morocco and visiting my family, and every summer there is no problem. He told me, no, in Canada we have three kind of lists. We have the A list. It's for pedophiles. The B list, it's for serial killers. and the C list, it's for presumed terrorists. And you are in this list. And the C, the last one, presumed terrorists. Presumed terrorists? I couldn't believe it. I'm talking about 2000, before 9/11. So I told him, who put me in this list? He told me, I cannot tell you. You have to call Transport Canada. I told him, Transport Canada is not it's not the police, it's not the RCMP. He told me, but this list it's managed by Transport Canada. So because I'm really têtu,
hard-headed.
I took the plane and I went to Morocco. And when I arrived there, they didn't arrest me, but I was waiting in the airport for 2-3 hours, and they checked my passport, my luggage, everything. And I have one of my family member, my uncle, working in the airport. So he met with the security there. And they told him, 4 o'clock morning, we received a call from Ottawa telling us the most dangerous terrorist is coming to Morocco. Perhaps because at this time, Moroccan government didn't trust them. They didn't arrest me. They checked my luggage and they released me. But I was followed everywhere by a car and two men. After my this trip, I was returning from Morocco to Montreal, and I did a transit in JFK Airport, New York. During this trip, one old lady from Morocco asked me to change my seats with her. She told me, my dear son, I have to use the bathroom every 30 minutes. Can we change? I told her, no problem. So I changed with my wife, and then I let her sit in my seats. During the transit, the SWAT team, FBI, immigration agents came in the plane with M16, with weapons, and they went directly to the old lady, asking her to follow them. The problem, the old lady, I'm not joking, it's incredible. She couldn't talk English, she couldn't speak French, so she was watching them, and the SWAT team was shouting and screaming, Sharkawi, and the message, Sharkawi, follow us. So the lady was telling them, je comprends pas, I don't understand. So I told them, I'm Sharkawi. So all the weapons were toward me. Handcuffed, they put me in the basement of the airport for hours. They switch off the lights, and time to time, a big guy from the security was threatening me like this. And they switch off the lights, they ask my wife to walk, and they put like a trail on the small window of the cell, so I could see my wife walking, and I was mad. Will they took out her hijab? Will they took out her clothes? I was screaming, beating the door. Nobody answered. I was waiting for hours. In the end, the FBI agent came to me and he told me, we are going to do an interrogation with you. And so I told him, look, I don't speak English. I need a translator. And believe me, I was really, I think, smart at this time to do it. Because when I was released, for example, in 2005, one journalist of CBC asked me for an interview, I said, no problem. And the first question was, Mr. Sharkawi, do you have any support in Canada? I told him, yes, I have a lot of support. There is many militants with me. He told me, militants? I see. Because in French, militant means activist. But with the FBI agent, I told him, I need a translator. So they brought to me a translator from IT. And the guy was horrible. He was mixing things. And I was talking in the past or in the conditional. He was translating in the future. And I couldn't correct. Imagine if I told them he's doing mistakes. It means I'm lying. So I was listening to him doing mistakes. And I couldn't correct. And they were recording, writing, taking notes. And it was incredible. The first question was, Mr. Sharkawi, why are you here? Why I'm here? Because you arrested me. So, Mr. Sharkawi, why are you here? I say, I don't know. You don't know? I say, but you arrested me from the plane. I was going to Montreal, and I'm a Moroccan citizen. I'm a landed immigrant in Canada. My father is Canadian. My mother. So, no. Look, we are very responsible agency. We are defending national security of United States, and we are defending Americans. We are not losing, wasting time and money for nothing. Why are you here? And I'm French literature teacher. So I have read before Kafka, Le Procès, The Trial. So he was asking me, so I told him, I don't know, perhaps I did something bad. For example, I said, perhaps I was stupid. One day I said F word to America. Suddenly, so you are against America. I said, no. I'm not saying I'm against America. I said, perhaps I did a mistake. What kind of mistake? Perhaps one day I was stupid. I said F word to Israel. Okay, so you're against Israel. I'm not telling you I'm against Israel. I'm just telling you, but what about Palestine? Okay, problems start now. Is it occupation there? See, the United Nations call it occupied territories. Suddenly, okay, this is the United Nations, but you, do you think it's an occupation? Yes, it's an occupation. And the groups fighting Israel, Hamas and those groups, are they terrorist group or resistance? Can I talk to my lawyer? No. Mr. Sharkawi, why are you here? I don't know. No, we are asking you. Perhaps I was giving martial arts to some Arabs and Muslims. I'm martial arts teacher. Okay, you're training Arabs. No, I'm not training Arabs and Muslims. I'm doing courses, I'm taking money. Okay, so they are paying you to train them. How can you defend yourself in such, you know? And the worst is telling me, look, you are United States, you are foreigner. We can detain you indefinitely. I will give you pen, pages, and you are going to do a brainstorming. Brainstorming, yes, brainstorming. All the Arabic names of young people between 18 and 45 you met in Montreal, and he started giving me names of the mosques and university. Concord University, Vincent Moriel, McGill. You know them? Give me names. Why? You can contact the Canadian government. They will give you all the names. No. I want the names you have in your memory. But it's really scary. I told him, look, perhaps a stupid guy give you my names. I'm not going to give you those names. It's not responsible to give you names of people. When I was arrested in 2003, FBI sent a report saying that Mr. Sharkawi was not cooperating with us. He was lying. Because I refuse to give names of people, innocent people, just like this. So he started with me since the beginning. He told me, look, we want all your life since the beginning, 1973, 3rd July, you're born. Okay, excellent. Tell me your friend in the daycare. My friend in daycare? He started giving me names of my neighbors. It's incredible. So, in the university in Morocco, your friend, leftist, Islamist, all those groups, all those people, all those students. And one time I was really happy at this time. Believe me, I was happy. I told him, look, you know everything about me. Even the blockbusters movies I was renting in Montreal. So you know that I'm innocent. He told me, Mr. Sharkawi, we are not joking. Why are you here? The same question. And I was repeating with him the same questions, one, second. In the end, I was really tired. I didn't sleep all the... In the end, these Asians, I told him, look, you look like Jim Carrey. So he started laughing and we started talking together. And he was, I think, sincere with me. He told me, look, here in America, we have nothing against you. You have problem with Ottawa. Go there and resolve your problems with the Canadian government. It was in 2001, February 2000, before 9/11. I arrived in Morocco, in Montreal with my wife. I went everywhere. Amnesty International. I want to see some Muslim association, Arabic association. Nobody helped me. Nobody. I want to see the legal aid. I told them, look, I need a lawyer to defend me. They told me, but you're not detained. Yeah, I know, I'm free. You're not accused. I'm not accused. We cannot defend you. Legal aid of people were in jail or arrested and you're free. And I couldn't pay for a lawyer. I didn't do anything at this time. I couldn't. And sometimes after, my mother received a call. It was from the federal government. And they asked me to call them. I called them and we did a meeting in the building of Immigration and Citizenship Canada. And the two gentlemen from CSIS, first meeting with them, they told me, we want to meet with you to discuss about your citizenship. Because your father and your mother, your sister, everybody got the citizenship and you're the only one waiting. I said, yes. So we sent you before a book. You have to read this book and to learn it. And to learn, Canada, you know, all this stuff. I said, yes, no problem. I read this many times. I'm waiting. So I'm still waiting now, 10 years after. So they told me, we want to ask you some question. I went to meet with them in this building. They asked me about Saddam Hussein. They ask me about Palestine. The same stupid questions. Look, I'm not in the Middle East. I'm from Morocco. Morocco is North Africa. I never went to the Middle East, one. Two, I came to this country. I was young with my family. And why are you asking me those questions? You just want to know your opinion, Mr. Sharkawi. Are you loyal to the Queen? Sorry, the Queen? Yes, you want to become Canadian. So you have to be loyal to the Queen. Did you ask this question to the Quebecers? It was the first meeting, so they scared me in New York, and they did to me this interview. Second meeting, third meeting. So I was really tired to answer the same question, and slowly they started showing me pictures of young Muslims in Montreal. In Montreal, we have a big Muslim community, more than 200,000. So they started showing me pictures of people I knew, I didn't. So, you know, it's really difficult. They show you somebody, you met with him one time, perhaps playing soccer or in the mosque, university. So if you tell them, I knew him, it's a contact. I don't know him. Okay, you have pictures. So it's, for example, I knew Tracy. I just met with her. But I don't know nothing about Tracy. But she was calling me in my cell phone in Victoria. She's my contact, and I'm her contact, but I don't know her, sincerely. The first time we met together, this is a contact for them. So now she's my contact. 3 days after 9/11, I received two gentlemen in my restaurant. Because what I didn't tell you, when I returned from Morocco and from United States, I felt that I was followed everywhere. And you know, our CSIS agents are really smart. In winter, you just open your window, you see two guys in a car with the lights on. It's pretty cold in Quebec, you know, minus 40. So, and in the summer, it's too hot. So just open the window and you can see two guys in a car with lights on. It's very hot, air conditioning. So you can see them. This is easy. And they were following me everywhere. And before I saw them, they were showing my picture to lots of my friends. So I started losing friends. And nobody told me that two officers or two CSIS agents were showing them my pictures. Nobody talked to me. I started also losing jobs. The school didn't renew my contract. The gym, martial arts gym, when I was giving courses, didn't renew my class. So I was losing jobs, friends, and I felt that I was isolated from the society. But I didn't have any evidence, and I was really naive to think that because my parents, my family are Canadian, and I will become Canadian, so I'm protected like all of you. So 3 days after 9/11, I opened at this time a restaurant because I couldn't work with my father. I was doing a master's degree part time, and I received a visit of two gentlemen. The first question they asked me 3 days after 9/11. Hi, Mr. Sharkawi. Hi, are you calling? Yes. Where is Mr. Osama bin Laden? The first question, and it was rush hour. I was working near Lisa B. Pearson School. Lots of students coming, taking slices of pizza. I was running everywhere. It was hot. And the first question they asked me, I told them, are you joking? No, it's Mr. Sharkawi. Where is Mr. Osama bin Laden? I cannot believe it. He's not smiling. He's not joking. He's serious. Sorry, I told him he's running mountain to mountain in Tora Bora, Afghanistan, so he's really tired and he's having a siesta in my basement, so please don't disturb him, let him sleep. No, it was absurdity. I stopped meeting with them because I felt that it was not really serious what they are doing. And they have written in the federal court that I was not collaborating. I told them that I'm not going to collaborate with you. I don't know what they mean by collaboration. To be snitch on my own community, to give names of people, to tell them that this guy is dangerous, this guy is not dangerous. How can I say that? It's insane. 2 years after, I was driving my wife, and I was really weak in this moment. My father was driving his car, and he did an accident. My mother was injured, and my wife broke her pelvis, and she was pregnant, so I was taking care to her. She was in the chair, So she couldn't move, she couldn't have a bath. I was really taking care of her, and all my family was injured. It was my situation. I was really weak at this time, lots of problems. I sold the restaurant, it was not working, and I was fed up. I told all my friends, my teachers in University of Montreal, I'm going to return to Morocco, definitely. I'm not going to stay here. I'm disgusted by those people. So at this moment, in Morocco, it was a big bombing in Casablanca. It was in 2003. And the Moroccan government arrested 5,000 people on suspicion. The Islamists, the communists, all East, feminists, leftists, all it is finished by East, they arrested them. And the first week, 18 death penalty. 18 condamnations à mort. 18 people were condemned to death penalty the first week. More than 20 or 30 life sentence. It was a huge arrestation in Morocco. 5 days after, I was driving my car to go to University of Montreal. A police car followed me. They asked me to stop. I stopped. They told me open the trunk. I went to open the trunk and they ran away. I was calling them, sir, sir, sir. I was surrounded by RCMP, Sûreté du Québec, Police de Montréal, Agence Service Frontalier, many services with weapons. And they told me, if you move, they are going to shoot you. Okay, handcuffed again, a car, directly to RDP jail, 21 months in small cell. All what they give me, it's a page, and they have written in this page. This document was a security certificate signed by two ministers, Denis Coderre, our neighbor, he's just living in the next street, he knew my father. Denis Coderre from the Liberal Party, and Wayne Easter, Solicitor General. In this page, it was written, Le Service Secret Canadien, CSIS, has grounds to believe that Mr. Sharkawi was, or he is, or he will be, dangerous for national security. CSIS has grounds to believe that Mr. Sharkawi was, or he is, or he will be engaged in terrorism. CSIS has grounds to believe that Mr. Sharkawi was, or he is, or he will be a member of Al-Qaeda. When I went to jail, I told them, where are you going? They told me, to jail. I told them, but why? They told me, you are going to deport you in 48 hours to your country. I told them, est-ce que j'ai fait quelque chose de mal? Did I do something wrong or bad? They told me, no, we have a special law, and you have right to deport you, you're a foreigner. I told them, I'm foreigner. My parents are Canadian. My children are Canadians. I'm living in this country half of my life. You're telling me I'm foreigner? He told me, yes, you're foreigner. I'm going to. Okay, but why are you going to put me in jail if I'm not criminal? You see, you told me it's an immigration law. You have to put me in an immigration center, not in jail. They throw me in the jail. And I will never forget this moment. I entered the first wing, G1. I saw four guys, big guys with tattoos, playing cards. The TV was on. I saw Osama bin Laden in a black horse after Osama bin Laden shooting. And the journalists were saying, today in Montreal, we arrested Adi Sharkawi. They were talking about me and showing bin Laden the 9/11 events. It was incredible. I couldn't believe it. And the guard called me, Mr. Adi Sharkawi, please, venez à la guérite. So all the guys were looking to me. This is the guy. This is the problems. It's why the border is closed now. No marijuana, no weapons from the United States. I'm the source of all those problems. I went to my cell. I put the pillow, the cover, and I went to use the bathroom. So somebody was following me. I said, I have to perhaps use my karate skills. And so the guy was following me. I told him, what's your problem, man? He told me, sir, I want an autograph. Autograph? Yes, you're the guy I saw on TV, in CTV, in CBC, talking about you, with people of 9/11. Are you crazy, man, or what? Autograph? So he insisted. So I wrote for him, good luck, from an innocent man, Adi Sharkawi. I would tell you that my experience in jail. Now I'm joking, I'm talking to you, I'm laughing, but I have written a poem during my experience in jail. And the jail, for me, it's the worst thing you can have in jail is the glass. You know the glass? People in Guantanamo, they don't see their families. They know that their families are far. In my situation, I saw my family 3 times a week, but I couldn't touch them. And this, it's really killing you. You see people you love just near you, but you cannot touch them. They are not far. They are really close. You cannot touch them. And I couldn't take in my hands my son, because my wife was pregnant at this time. And she showed me my son behind the glass. And believe me, it's killing you every time. And when the state allow you to meet with your family, what they call visit contact, you have to sit in a table like this. You're sitting here, they're sitting there. And you have 2 guards watching you, micros in the table, and they call it contact visit. What contact visit? And they insisted, Mr. Shakawi, you don't have right to kiss or to touch. Okay, you are Muslim, we don't touch each other in public. And they are insisting, okay, my children, you cannot touch. This is contact visit in jail. Jail is also something very important. After 6 months, I became member of the committee. You know, in every wing, there is a committee, 5-6 people ruling the wing. And the new people have to ask you permission to switch on TV or take coffee or to use phone. And with time, I had the feeling that I was changing. I start talking like bikers, like they put me with bikers, Hells Angels. They put me with the Blood and Crips. I'm not white, I'm not black, so they put me with whites, with blacks. I was CDP, Boga. They put me everywhere. So when I was member of the committee, I felt that I was changing. I start talking like criminals. Yo, man, what you want? I'm not like this. And you started having a different behavior. You're talking with your wife, she's talking about milk, about your children, and the guy telling you, prepare yourself, big bottle. Okay. You know, it's not you, it's not me, but you have to survive. And in jail, you have to become a lion, a wolf. You cannot be a sheep. So, and this also killing you. You don't want to change. You're not criminal, but they force you to change. And you start having another behavior, another language.
You are listening to The Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Ardil Sharkawi has been talking about his experiences being targeted under the Security Certificate Program. His remarks help to counteract the depersonalization that state agencies have tried to impose on those who have been so targeted, and also illustrate the inhumanity and even absurdity of this program, which he characterizes as Kafkaesque.
And I would tell you that this experience in jail perhaps was easier for me because I was in Quebec. I kept my clothes, not like, for example, the 4 other men in Ontario, orange suit and isolation. So it's really different. But even if it's the conditions are not very hard like Ontario, I will tell you, just 1 hour, if you're innocent in jail, it's you can never be you cannot even if they give you all the money of the world, it's not 1 hour if you're innocent in jail, because you never did something bad, you don't deserve to be in jail. And imagine if you're innocent. I will tell you something, perhaps one anecdote in jail. I met one guy from Ontario. His name Airborne. This guy was paid by the bikers 2 packages of cigarettes every week to kill mosquitoes. You know, people, respectable people like bikers, they are playing cards. They don't want to be disturbed by mosquitoes. So they pay this guy every week 2 packages of cigarettes. He was just killing mosquitoes every day. So one day I found him opening the door of the yard. I said, what are you doing, man? You're opening the door? He told me, yes. I said, but there is lots of mosquitoes entering. He told me, I have to survive. Okay. I have to smoke. And when I was released, I was listening to Jim Judd, head of CSIS, repeating the same discourse every year. Yes, in Canada, we are defending national security. We are Sadi Sharkawi, Muhammad Harkat, the same names every year, every year, every year. 9 billion, the budget of national security in Canada. Okay? Killing mosquitoes. If there's no mosquitoes, they will create them. I just want to tell you that after this experience in jail, during 21 months, I decided not to participate in such a parody. I was not testifying in the court, and I was not participating. And when the judge, Simon Noel of the Federal Court, noticed that I was not participating, he told me, if you testify, I will release you. But between you and me, I didn't trust it. I didn't trust it. I didn't trust the Federal Court, not the system at this time. So I did a lie detector polygraph. I did it 4 times and I passed it 4 times. And we picked the best expert. He was working for the RCMP, informed by the FBI. We took the result and we sent it to 2 independent experts, and they confirmed that I was not lying. I'm not a terrorist. We took those results and I testified to the judge and I explained to him. I told him the truth. You know what they gave me when I was arrested, 1 week after, 400 pages. In those 400 pages, the government was CSIS actually. They put some biographies of Osama bin Laden, speeches of Saddam Hussein, the list of all terrorist group, how to escape from surveillance, how to build the bombs. Lots of crazy things, but nothing about me. Except 14 pages. In those 14 pages, they were talking about the profile, my profile. Saying that Sharkawi fits a profile of sleeper agents. And this profile is based on 8 points. The first one, he's Arab and Muslim. The second one, he's young. The third one, he's educated. He's doing a master's degree and wants to do his PhD. Number 4, he's coming from the middle class. Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri, all those people are not poor. They are from the middle class. So they are not just working to eat, but to cherish the government's subversion. Number 5, he has a restaurant, he can finance terrorism. Number 6, it's incredible profiling. Number 6, he's married and he has children. Number 7, he's martial arts expert. Number 8, he did a trip to Pakistan. This is my profile. I was arrested because I fit the profile of sleeper agents. So I explained to the judge that he cannot, those people, CSIS, I mean, they didn't tell him the truth. When they told him that I was a martial arts expert and I was doing karate like the 19 men of 9/11, I told him, look, I started martial arts, I was 11 years old. Am I preparing myself to commit an attack, since I was 11 years old? Second, they told you, I'm married to have a cover. I told him, my wife, I knew her since 1990. She was my neighbor. Actually, she was my teacher in Morocco. It was a love story. And we have 2 children, and we want more. And it's more than 10 years of marriage. Now it's 11 years. At this time it was perhaps 5 years. And third, they told you that I was in Pakistan. Yes, I was in Pakistan, but I was in Pakistan, in Turkey, in Egypt, in France, in Belgium, in Spain, United States. I stopped telling him all the countries I have visited. Why? They just told you he was in Pakistan. Point. And my lawyer did a fantastic job. We found when I was in jail that this profiling of terrorists was the consequences of the work of one man. His name is Mark Salzman. Mark Salzman was a former CIA agent. He was helping what Reagan was calling the freedom fighters to fight communism in Afghanistan. So when he finished his dirty work financing those people to beat communists, He returned to the United States and he did his PhD in psychiatry. And he wrote a book about the profile of Mujahideen for every region of the world, North Africa, Middle East, South Asia. And what CSIS did, they took this profile and they applied it on me, the profile of Mujahideen of North Africa, Maghreb. And my lawyer told the judge, you cannot rely on such a profile. It's not scientific. For example, if they arrest him because he's rich, okay, and if he's rich, he can finance terrorism, but if he's poor, he can be bought by money. Okay, you are arresting him because he's educated, and if he has no instruction, no education, he can be brainwashed in madrasas in Pakistan. It's easy to brainwash him. Okay, you're saying that you arrested him because he's married, and he's a cover. Okay, if he's single, he will be candidate to martyr. So anyway, you're losing. You cannot win with profiling. And the judge released me at this time in 2005 with draconian conditions, 50,000 bell, GPS device, with this satellite device, so I'm followed everywhere. I have another big brother at home connected to my phone line. So three tools for big brother. They have right to enter my, at this time, they had right to enter my house without warrants anytime. I cannot go outside the island of Montreal, no internet, no PCs, no cell phone. My father and my mother had to supervise me everywhere. I'm a teacher. I was teaching after my release in my classroom, teaching teenagers, 18 years old, and my mother sitting in the back of the classroom supervising me. Believe me, it's incredible. The teenagers, the students were playing in the yard. I'm supervising them and my mother supervising me during 4 years. In 2007, the Supreme Court of Canada decided in Sharkawi 1 that secure certificates are unconstitutional. It was a big victory for me, for all immigrants, for all Canadians. But unfortunately, the conservative government didn't apply this decision. And they just introduced the same law, C3. I went to the parliament in front of the Committee of Justice and I told them that this law is still inconstitutional. I went to see in front of the Senate, the Committee of Public Safety of the Senate. I told them the same thing. We were 90 interveners and nobody listened to us. And the Liberal Party, we did a demonstration in the riding of Stéphane Dion in Saint Laurent. He met with us and he told us, I'm scared that if I vote against this law, Stephen Harper will get the majority. And if he gets the majority, he will change Canada. So he voted for this law. In 2008, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in another decision that CSIS doesn't have right to destroy evidence. It's incredible. I will just summarize this Supreme Court decision before finishing. We are sitting now talking, you are listening to me, and CSIS, before the Supreme Court asked them to change the law, perhaps they are recording. They will record these events. They will do a transcription of the tape. They will destroy the tape. They will take the transcription. They will make a summary of transcription. They will destroy the transcription. They will take the summary, they will give it to a senior agent. He will write what they call operational reports. He will destroy the summary. In this operational report, for example, they can write, Mr. Sharkawi was speaking against national security of Canada. And many people with names of some of them were sitting and listening to him and they were supporting him in his extremist ideas. For example, so if they give it in the secret evidence and I want to defend myself, I have no evidence to show that I was not talking against national security of Canada. But the judge who will see the secret evidence will absolutely trust the state agent, not me, the poor immigrant. So the Supreme Court of Canada was clear. you cannot destroy the tapes. But he says, at this time, the prosecutor told the Supreme Court of Canada, but we have two strong arguments. The first one, we are spying on lots of immigrants. Where can we put all those evidence? So the lawyer of Le Barreau du Québec, Maître Poupard, showed just the nine judges a CD. They told them, you have this, a CD. Just put all those files in the CD. And the second argument was also crazy. They told the court, we didn't destroy just two interviews of Mr. Sharkawi. We are destroying everything. Because we have a policy, OPS 217. And this policy allow us to destroy all the tapes, the recording. It's incredible. So the nine judges told them, you have to change your policy. This their last argument. We are not spying on citizens, just on immigrants. But you know the problems. I'm immigrants, you're a citizen. They are recording everything. So it applies to you. So perhaps today it's me, tomorrow it will be you. Thank you.
Today on The Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM, you heard two members of a panel discussion on June 26, 2009, entitled The Other RRs, Where the Exception is the Rule. The first speaker was Jason Grattle, lawyer and member of the BC Civil Liberties Association. The next speaker was Ardil Sharkawi, targeted since the year 2000 and then imprisoned under the Security Certificate Program. Both speakers emphasized the importance of resolute opposition to this attack on the civil liberties not only of immigrants, but of all Canadians.
Back when the head of conflict and subversion, they asked every working person, are you now or have you ever been? Are you now or have you ever been a member of a union? Are you now or have you ever been? I never thought I'd see the day I'd hear those words come round again. Are you now or have you ever been? Hard at work, soft on unions, that's the average Louisvillian. American expressly stated in their press release. Our site selection test committee recommend another city where business rolls in profits and the unions rest in peace. And every day that question sounds a little more familiar as another union battle flag descends. Ask any airline traffic tracker, millwright, miner, or meat packer, are you now or have you ever been? Are you now or have you ever been a member of a union? Did your mother, father, uncle, cousin wear a union pin? I never thought I'd see the day I'd hear those words come round again. Are you now or have you ever been? Corporate planners dutifully bought folks of Louisville a one-way nowhere fare on the American Express. Will we leave the driving to the bosses? Make concessions, take the losses. This union's got the disappearing railroad blues. Unless we dare to use the power we've been sitting on for years, we're strong enough to call that bluff, my friend. Just take your lousy plant and shoot. shove it. Yes, I'm union, damn proud of it. I am now, and I have always been. Are you now?